Hey, Zach and Jacob, what's Mass Minimal anyways?
Mass Minimal is the place where you can be yourself.
So tune in every Wednesday and we promise you good health.
So come along and play with us, and then you will see. Mass Minimal is the place where you can be.
So come play with us.
Mass Minimal.
Hey, y'all.
Hey.
Welcome to this week's episode of Mass Minimal.
I'm Jacob.
And I'm Zach.
And this
is one of the most exciting moments in my whole life. How about you?
I'd say this is Mass Minimal, but not any Mass Minimal. Zach, why is this Mass Minimal different from all other Mass Minimals?
I'm so excited. I feel like we have to prepare. We have to have something prepared to adequately talk about this guest today, man. I don't feel like I can just do it off the top of my head. I wish we had written something.
Do you mean like a very polished summary of our guest's accomplishments and kind of the broad outline of her life?
I mean, that would be great, but like,
if only that was on a Google Drive document. Mere feet in front of me.
But
it is.
Oh, yes.
Who is our guest this week? Our guest this week is Elizabeth Alexander, an artist and academic who often blurs the lines between these two categories. She grew up in Washington, D.C., where her father, Clifford Alexander, was Secretary of the Army under President Carter, and where her mother, Adele Logan Alexander, still teaches history at George Washington University. As an undergraduate, Alexander attended Yale, where she was classmates with such luminaries as hip-hop scholar Trisha Rose and psychiatric geneticist James Potash.
That's your dad.
LOL. Having never written poetry, she went on to study the form under Derek Walcott, who she credits as her only teacher at Boston University. She earned a doctorate from the University of Pennsylvania and played an important role in the early days of the Cave Canem Writers' Retreat with Toy Derricotte and Cornelius Eady. She taught at the University of Chicago and Smith College before eventually finding her way back to Yale as a professor of poetry, American studies, and African American studies. She's published 4 collections of poetry since 1990, The Venus Hottentot, Body of Life, Antebellum Dream Book, and American Sublime, as well as a book of critical essays, The Black Interior. In 2009, she became one of the best-known poets in the world when she was chosen to compose a poem for Barack Obama's first inauguration, where she read her poem, Praise Song for the Day. Next week, she will release The Light of the World, a memoir in which she explores the vast array of emotions surrounding the loss of her husband, who died suddenly almost 3 years ago exactly.
Last semester, I took Professor Alexander's freshman seminar, 20th Century African American Poetry. It was actually 20th and 21st century. We updated it as the time went on. And it was such an amazing introduction to college. She was incredibly accessible with the 12 people in our seminar, willing to share the vast knowledge of the art form that she has. And Jacob and I are currently in her class, African American Studies 194, Contemporary African American Art. And she just has this incredible commitment to creating a thriving arts community, a thriving Black arts community that's very rooted in the present day and is very current and thinks of itself as creating important art now. And that's really exciting to be a young person in that kind of, in the presence of someone like that. And we modeled our show a little bit about that. We do, her class is kind of about giving background information about certain artists and doing lecture. And then every week we have a living artist come in and speak with us in interview form. So in a way, I think that's kind of Mass Minimally, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Or we're pretty her classy, you know. I think it's more that way. So we conducted this interview on Tuesday morning. It was very exciting. She's in the midst of a very busy time in preparation for the release of The Light of the World, her memoir, and which I've heard her read a bit of, and it's just like amazing work. And we kind of got into what it was like to create it during this interview. Yeah, really enjoyed this interview a lot. So to begin, well, I need to preface this a little bit. Last month, Elizabeth Alexander performed with Jason Moran at the Village Voice. The Village Vanguard. Different. One is a place, and another is a publication. And the one that is a place, she performed there, and neither of us got to go. So we created this little mashup of a Jason Moran piece and a poem by her. Yeah.
Last week, when the New Yorker's theater critic Hilton Knowles visited class, he actually told Professor Alexander that this was one of the best performances he'd ever seen in his life at the Village Vanguard, and that she should quit teaching and dedicate herself in the next phase of her career to performance. So that's exciting.
Yeah, so without further ado, here's the interview, beginning with a mashup of Jason Moran's Refraction 1 and Elizabeth Alexander reading The Black Woman Speaks. We hope you enjoy it all. It's going to be fun.
I am 35, and the love of my life and my great work and my three sons and my new nation are ahead of me. Goodbye, Chicago. About to set out for the territory, Mexico, for the rest of the century and into the next. My sense of my people will strengthen and shift. But first, I had to leave DC. You have to leave DC. Lovely colored town that will make a color girl smile, but not stretch or growl or frown with the exertion of thinking, work. Yet there I made my first carving from a cake of ivory soap at Dunbar High School. There I was taught. There I stood in front of the United States Supreme Court with a noose around my neck protesting lynching. There I realized I had a debt I had not paid. I am black because my great-great-grandmother was kidnapped on a beach in Madagascar. In Mexico, I will carve black women's bodies and heads from reddish stone and black stone. Some will be massive, and the work will make me sweat. The black woman's head is a massive weight. The black woman's head holds the black woman's brain. The black woman's body holds the black woman's head. The black woman's work is the work of this world. The black woman's work is the work of this world.
I have lots of coughs today. Because I have tuberculosis.
Do you really? That is a terrible disease to have in the 21st century.
No, I'm being you. But who is also me?
Elizabeth Alexander, welcome to Mass Minimal.
It's great to be here with you guys.
This is very exciting.
I could not be more pumped for this interview. It's a bit of a departure for our brand, but I think we're the better for it.
We only have a short amount of time, so I'm going to get right to the meat of it.
Yes, of course.
This is a music podcast, and so we're kind of interested in you. You've talked a little bit about your poetry starting from the body, and I was wondering what you think about all art potentially starting from the body, and is that the musical impulse that's inherent in people that all art comes from, or do you feel like it's mostly poetry and music, or do you think it's everywhere?
That's a great question. I think that certainly, yes, music starts from and lives in the body in a very, very explicit way. If you're talking about instrumental music, it is with, you know, a delivery medium. But vocal music absolutely can't exist unless it has a source. And I think that sense of the body and its emotions and its feelings and its expressive possibility. And my own interest in music that has tremendous virtuosity and formal accomplishment, but that also has a very human break or excess in it, has everything to do with the embodiment of song.
How does that seep into your poetry? Where did the worlds collide? And I'm assuming you were a fan of music before you started writing poetry. And how has that informed your practice?
Yes, well, I always, so my parents, especially my dad, were music listeners. They had an eclectic record collection. They not the hugest record collection ever, but a really interesting one. They had the Supremes, they had Frank Sinatra, they had the Fifth Dimension, they had the Modern Jazz Quartet, they had Dave Brubeck, they had Duke Ellington. So, you know, kind of 60s cool music, and music of a tremendous formal resolution and accomplishment. But then there were also a few wild cards, like they had Janis Joplin's Big Brother and the Holding Company, which was sort of a little different from the other stuff there. And in that, in the way that when you listen to your parents' records or you read your parents' books and you don't have an infinite amount of them, so you read them or listen to them over and over and over again, I listened over and over and over again to those records and knew that in the Janis Joplin there was something excessive that really interested me, that there was something that was more raw or that went over the edge or that wasn't composed anymore. And so I think that in my and then I started, listening to music myself. I remember growing up in cities, growing up in Washington, D.C., when there were record stores, and there was a record store named Kemp Mill. It was a small chain. There were two of them, and they had a bargain bin. So as a young person, I remember very well, like 13, being old enough to go out on my own with my own money and start to build my own collection, which was mostly jazz at the time, although also I've always listened to pop and soul and radio music. I think the radio is really, really important, and that's why I hate when the radio is bad and canned and off of, you know, one playlist that just repeats over and over again and that has to do with all of the commercial efforts to pump records. That's very different from the kind of DJing that I grew up with. There was a really great DJ in DC named Felix Grant, who had a nighttime or evening starting at 9 o'clock jazz show on WMAL. It was an AM jazz station. And the basics of my jazz education as such, I mean, you know, again, my parents listened to jazz, but understanding kind of where things fit together came from listening to Felix Grant when I would do my homework every night from 9 to 12, that was my accompaniment. So you can learn so much that way. And I think there are other sources now that radio is not what it was. But I valued that a great deal. So just to get back to your question, I think that the aspect of music that is formally very polished and controlled, and I am interested in virtuosity in poetry and that kind of level of excellence, but I think there always needs to be a break or an opening or a wild hair or a wild card.
And then speaking of taking one medium and kind of translating it into another, you're coming out with a memoir, and how does your work as a poet inform the memoir? And there are so many familiar tropes of a pretty popular medium, which is the memoir. And so how do you avoid those, and how do you translate what you've learned from poetry into the work of making an interesting memoir?
You should tell me what those tropes are so I can make sure that I didn't use or abuse them.
It'll all be in the review.
There you go. I never set out to write a memoir. I never imagined I would write a memoir. And I think of this very much as a poet's memoir. The chapters are, for the most part, very, very short, very concentrated, but they are not prose poems. And I think that the distinctions are really important, some of which fall under the rubric of I know it when I see it, I know it when I've done it or I haven't done it. Claudia Rankine's Citizen, a book you all know, that is prose poetry. That is not prose. What I wrote is prose, but it's a poet's prose. And so one little short, concentrated word cloud at a time, I wrote these things. And then eventually, when a group of them stacked up, I began to see and be able to shape what the whole was. So, but I think always with tremendous attention to the importance of the word, of each, you know, absolutely scimitar shimmering word. And that without that sense of language, I wouldn't have felt that it was a book, A, that I recognized as coming from me, but B, that was actually up to the incredible difficulty of the topic, which is to say, both writing about grief and writing about love.
And to kind of piggyback on that concept of writing about grief and writing about love and these really, really important topics, what experiences and what traumatic experiences do you think contribute to art making, and what can kind of derail you? And is there a clear distinction, or is it kind of up to fate? Is it up to your own choice to make the art? What do you find to be debilitating, and what do you find to be fruitful in truth telling and art making?
That's interesting, and I don't think there's any one rule either for me or for other writers. There is a writer and scholar who's a friend of mine who had a very, very, very catastrophic loss. Lost first a child and then her husband a year later, and she has obliquely written about it. You know, she's studied other. She's a religious scholar and has studied things that help her understand the mysteries of catastrophe and survival. But she said that only now, and I think it's maybe 20 years after, she's thinking that she might write about the actual it. She never imagined that she would write about the it. On the other hand, I found, and again, this is all who knew, you know, that right. I did not want to move too far away from or out of the experience of losing my husband and moving through that profound grief, because I knew it would be another thing. I didn't want it to have any of the veneer of nostalgia. And because I learned anew something about who I was as an artist and the necessity of art with which to actually know how I perceive. The writing helped me know where I was in the world. And that's, as it turns out, what art does regardless of what you're writing about.
You recently read at the Village Vanguard with with Jason Moran.
I performed.
You performed. that's the distinction I was I was wanting to get at. First of all, I think what you're talking about with trying to have things be less nostalgia and more in the moment, working, trying to discover what your feelings are. That reminds me a lot of what jazz does, is get up on the bandstand, the changes are playing, now it's your time to figure out where you're coming from. Can you tell me a little bit about that experience and what that was like for you?
Well, it was an amazing experience, because I think that, you know, again, as a lover of jazz, as a student of jazz, as a scholar and lover of African American culture, the improvisatory tradition is something that's well known to me. But I think that what I knew that came very, very clear is that improvisation only works if you're extremely, extremely prepared. You know, it only works if your instrument, whatever that may be, is, you know, at the ready. It only works if you, you know, put your hands on your instrument in a regular fashion so that you can express what you want to express. You know, you have to be in shape in order to be able to have latitude and to surprise yourself. And I think that also for me, that being in shape, if you will, that preparation was that I did have texts. I did have things that I had written that I was pleased with. But then what to do with it and how to, it is about being in the moment of art. And about the really important aspect of why I like collaboration and why I like teaching, listening to other people, reading where other people are, and just being fully present and being willing to go in one direction or go in another direction, and being willing to take a risk that could make you feel foolish, but being, you know, kind of on your toes enough to recover. That's also, I think, the addiction and the excitement to see, like, almost like, I got away with it. We did it. And that something in that alchemy, you know, a third thing was created from the two.
So you said that you didn't set out to write this book, this memoir. You never thought you would. Does that mean that all these individual bursts of that turned into these different small chapters, were those each kind of improvisational? Were these each just thoughts or feelings that you felt like you had to express, and then it's kind of discovered that they had become this collection?
A little bit differently. The book was really almost commissioned. An editor who knew my work and knew that my husband had passed very, very gingerly approached me through my agent and said, you know, if I should go away, I'll go away. But I think that she could write an amazing book about this. And, you know, would she want to talk to us? And I mean, literally, I sort of felt like I kind of, you know, washed my face, took off my widow's dress, and went on the train to have this conversation that I just didn't even know almost why I was there. But something said, just go. And my editor, Gretchen Young, was a very, very extraordinary midwife to this book, and said that she would take it without a proposal. That never happens, because I said, well, I can't write a proposal. I don't know what I'll feel tomorrow. I don't know what I'm thinking. When I accepted the advance for the book, I put it aside because I really believed that I would have to give it back. I didn't think that I could do it, but I thought, well, let's just see, because the truth was that I had been writing these little things anyway. I hadn't been thinking about what would happen with them, but I had been writing them, and I did know that writing was something that I needed to do and was able to do. And then it went from there.
On this show, we ask our guests to come up with their three, it doesn't have to be the most influential, but three influential pieces of music that contribute to their work today. And if you could just talk a little bit about each of those, and we'll play a little bit of the music as well.
That's great. So, and as I told you, I was disobedient, and so I picked many things. So we'll see how quickly I can speak. But I was thinking, you know, there's so much that's been influential, so I could go on and on. But a few that have been really important. One is Sly Stone's version of Que Sera Sera, which was actually on Scandal the other night, and I was really mad because I thought that was my little secret. But now everybody knows. But I think that, you know, first of all, in the African-American tradition of revising things from another canon, things from a Western canon or a European canon, or in this case, from the American songbook, the idea that Doris Day's song would be in Sly Stone's mouth is just, to me, America. And fascinating.
Here's what she said to me.
It's akin to John Coltrane playing My Favorite Things. You know, I like all of the great works of black music that do that. And I think that also show us, I think that Julie Andrews singing My Favorite Things, I love show tunes. I like their largeness and broadness. I think she's unbelievable. But when you hear what John Coltrane does with that tune, it is to realize the brilliance of, you know, this thing we've been talking about, African-American deformation of mastery, mastery of deformation. What you can do with something when you bend it, when you take it elsewhere, where you go in surprising directions. So to that, Sly Stone's Que Sera Sera, to think that he could turn a Doris Day song into a blues, and the truth of it in his mouth as being profoundly about black life. So, you know, Que Sera Sera, whatever will be, the future's not ours to see, is true for everybody. But I think when you hear him singing it, and you, in that black idiom, there's something that's even deeper that emerges, in addition to his surrendering and the people he sings with, his sister Rose, you know, hearing the community come in to sing the song with him, and to surrender to the heft of what they're actually saying. It's like they're listening to what they're saying. So it breaks down, and it really breaks down with the guitar at the end, which I think is incredibly powerful. So that's one thing that I really love.
Mm-hmm.
the futures that I was to see.
I think also Leontine Price singing, and it's sort of in this, so you can tell I've kind of got a theme here. My Man's Gone Now from Porgy and Bess. Have you all heard that?
I've heard versions of it, but I haven't
heard version. Her version.
Okay, that's
her
the
version.
One.
And what I find interesting about that is, again, you know, it's we could talk all day about Porgy and Bess, and you know, there's sort of a weirdness to some of those songs. But I think, you know, if you think again in show tunes of Jennifer Hudson singing "I Am Telling You I'm Not Going," for example, and that, you know, African American tradition of just laying it out, falling out, you know, like just like putting it out there and having your church moment. Leontine Price goes to that extremity of emotion. And so I think, you know, and having written a book about grief and having to understand true human extremis and how to express that, she goes all the way to the shattered and broken down place, but with such profound formal control. But it is, she does dissemble. But she expresses it with perfect control. It's just a feat of virtuosity in the service of emotional wreckage that I think is completely amazing. I'm not a real opera listener, you know, or opera fan in particular, but when you hear what that instrument can do and what she has to be able to understand as an artist to be able to go to that place. And then what you hear at the end of the song is that, you know, my man's gone now, my man, you know, he's gone, he's dead, he's not coming back. And then the community with this chant, they go, oh, and they really rise her up, they give her voice. I'll be talking about this in class because it's just so amazing. So I think the whole thing is cinematic and dramatic in a 3.5 minute song. There's an entire, like, beginning, middle, and end. So I think that dramatic structure in a small space is just completely, completely, completely amazing. I want to say more than three, but just for now, I'll say Prince's How Come You Don't Call Me Anymore, which is, first of all, a B-side. I really believe in B-sides in general.
Yes.
B-sides are very, very important. And it's also, just to tell the story of it, you know, coming of age as a record person, like, I couldn't find that record for the longest, like, I searched for it for years. And it went out of print, or it, you know, maybe this was when things had moved. I don't know quite what happened, but I searched. So there's great reward when you find a thing that you heard once and you couldn't find, and then you find it. And it's very, very spare Prince, which I think, you know, because Prince can do anything. I think when you hear him stripped down, and you know, and again, you hear all of the feeling in his voice. Alicia Keys does a very nice version of the song. A couple other people have covered it as well. But the plaintiveness in Prince is, and just, you know, that whole black male musical tradition of begging. you know, like just like I love you that much. Like, you know, so it's the male version of just laying it out.
How come you don't call me anymore?
And that you also hear the deep, deep, deep early soul roots in his music, bluesier roots before soul got kind of shiny and composed and Sam Cooke-ish. You know, it's like he that's all in Prince's voice there. It's very, very, very raw. And the feeling is very, very raw, and it's very, very exquisitely unadorned. And so I think that when you can, that's another kind of virtuosity, when you can just be very, very plain and unadorned and just kill it.
I didn't think that would have been kind of cute together.
Tell me, baby, 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 why you wanna go and break my heart? Call me girl.
I wish we could do this all day. This is so fun. Those are three amazing.
Do you know those?
Well, I don't know all of them. I know the beginning one and the last one, but not the middle. So that'll be really exciting.
Good.
To pull up, and we'll have the music in there. We have one more segment, which is very exciting. It's kind of a game. And Jacob will explain the very.
Oh, is it Name That Tune? Am I going to fail?
No, you cannot fail.
Okay.
So the name of this game, which is our last segment, is Mass Minimal. It's just a coincidence that it's on the show Mass Minimal. How it works is we give you a word or a phrase or a thing, and you tell us whether that thing is mass or minimal and why. And the thing is, it's up to you to determine what mass and minimal mean.
Okay.
So consider it a poetic, interpretive exercise. And to start off with, we have...
The art world, capital A, capital W.
Mass or minimal?
Oh, my God. Mass, in the sense of it has become mass mediated. Is that how we?
That's how.
Yes.
That's it.
Oh, great.
Yeah, more.
Okay, and we've heard a little bit from you in the past about this, but To Pimp a Butterfly by Kendrick Lamar.
To Pimp a Butterfly. Mass because it's ambitious, you know, because it's a little too long, a little too much, but that's actually a really great thing.
That reminds me a little bit about the whole thing you talk about sometimes about before your mother told you before you leave the house, or was it your grandmother?
My grandmother, yeah, take one thing off. See, no one told Kendrick.
Yeah, no one told Kendrick. But that's almost cool, I guess.
It's extra, yeah.
It's an extra.
And it's also generous, actually. Sometimes there's a kind of that kind of massness that is just a refusal to be edited. But I think when you're actually trying to share a lot,
yeah,
that's that. And I sort of feel like it's coming from that place. That's a good thing.
And I think that massness may be one of the reasons some people are having a hard time getting it.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it's kind of refusing to not be complicated.
Because
It's people like, oh, this is about that. Almost like with your book, you said that they're listing it under grief.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's like, okay, but there's also a lot of other stuff.
A whole lot of other stuff.
Like joy that comes, and that's confusing. And yeah, I think that this album works on that level a little bit. Sorry, I just interrupted the game with
That's
my
okay.
own thoughts. You're involved in a lot of these panel discussions, mass or minimal.
Panel discussions. I was in a panel on a panel discussion at the Schomburg last night about ancestral witness, about Amiri Baraka and Maya Angelou and their sort of living legacies, with several very, very smart and interesting and generous people, Eddie Gloud of Princeton, Farrah Griffin of Columbia, Aubrey Hendricks of Columbia, thinking about the difference between religion and spirituality in Black life and with these writers. And that was, even though I think that in my profession there are too many panels, there are too many conferences, there's just too much of that, it's mass. When you have a really wonderful one, you know, we just wanted to pour some wine for the audience and keep talking, because there was a sense that here were two very, very different titans. Here were two mass people, and that there was so much to talk about, and it was so enriching, and everyone was giving their all to the conversation. So in a bad mass genre, it was a good mass conversation.
A touching note to end on, but Yale students taking consulting jobs. Mass, minimal. Not that you know any of them.
I do, but no, here's what I truly, truly think. What is interesting about having taught for many, many years and seeing what my students have done is that most of them do not become artists. Most of them do not become professors. But when they go off and take consulting jobs or banking jobs or lawyer jobs or whatever, they write to me years later. And the things that they learned about Black culture still do live with them in very, very meaningful ways. And so I don't know if that means that one day with all that money, they'll fill their walls with paintings by Black people, or they'll fund schools, or what they'll do. But I actually don't think it's only one thing to have a rich cultural, ethical, and political education and take it in that direction. I think it's all who you become when you do that work. So that is like, that's a hard one for mass or minimal, but I guess I would have to say mass with no further explanation.
Wow. This has been so great. We have to go, I guess.
I wish we could keep going.
I know. Well, I guess that's just another reason to do this again. If you'd be willing.
Yes.
Next year, semester or whatever, but this is been very exciting, and we've modeled our format a little bit after the way you've done your class this semester, and
that's great.
We thank you for that and apologize for biting your style a little bit.
Thank you. You know what, if we had more time, so I thought maybe we would do like Aretha or Shaka. I think you should add that to your games,
like Aretha or Shaka, or like choosing between the two.
You know how they
have. Okay, okay, really quick.
On the radio,
really quick.
They do that.
Yeah, you ready?
And they all day, we're going to play Luther and Freddie Jackson.
Yeah. So, Prince or Michael?
Oh, man. Michael.
And maybe you're not allowed to explain. I feel like.
Ask me a bunch quickly, and then maybe I'll go back and explain.
Okay. Biggie or Pac?
Biggie.
Shaka or Aretha?
Shaka.
Oh, what's another great oh, Miles or Train?
Totally Train.
Every time.
Totally Train.
I don't.
Stevie.
Yeah,
that's too easy.
That's they're just based on Blind.
Is
that Blind piano. What else? Who's a good two?
Mariah or Ariana.
No, Ew.
That was a joke.
Oh, Drake or Kanye?
Okay, so my children, who you hear much about, find me amusing when I like try to be in their world.
Yeah,
I like new Drake. I am like, every time Drake comes on the radio now, I'm like, guys, oh my God, I like this Drake. But I think that Kanye is a much more original artist. And from what I read and hear, not knowing a whole ton, I think that his creativity, I mean, I think that you know, Drake is an interesting singer, but Drake is not creating anything. He's an instrument of someone else's vision. He says, but Kanye is creative. He's making his own vision. So even though I'm now enjoying the sound of Drake, I think the accomplishment of Kanye far, far, far exceeds.
I totally see that.
Is that not true?
No, I agree. Mm-hmm. And also, like, a little bit, the whole framework of the mass or minimal thing mm-hmm. is, for me, Kanye is the touchstone artist for my life. Like, 2004, when I was just first really realizing what music was, that was when his first album came out. So he's the first artist, the real genius that I got to follow all the way.
Yeah.
And his albums went from, like, totally, you know, maximalist to the most minimal pieces of music I've ever heard. And so that's where the kind of mass minimal
mm-hmm.
thing.
Mm-hmm.
Quick question. Who is that artist for you that you feel like you grew up with, you saw him from the beginning, you've been with him ever since?
A couple. Ladies and gentlemen, Earth, Wind, and Fire. So that was definitely yeah. The idea that there was music that you could dance to that would also feed your soul. That it spoke to the, like, really kind of groovy black girl I was and am inside. I keep going back to, like, I like virtuosity. I think those horns are unbelievable. Tight in the same way that I like, El Gran Combo. I like salsa for that, like, great salsa, because I think that all of that polyrhythmic horn movement is just so accomplished and so exhilarating and thrilling that it bedazzles me.
To all of our listeners, you must pick up the Gratitude Live album.
Yes.
That when my dad played that for me in the car driving to Santa Barbara one time, and mm-hmm. it changed my entire view of what music was.
Yes, 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 yes.
And with that, are there any final words you need to leave us with before we depart? Have we missed anything?
No, this has been wonderful. The mother in me says, listen to music every day, but don't turn it up so loud that you hurt your ears.
You heard it here first. There we go. Okay, well, this has been Mass Minimal, our most exciting interview yet. And hopefully there is more to come.
Thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
Appreciate it.